responded at 12:59 p.m. Chelsea, Google Dr. Jack Kevorkian and you can educate yourself on euthanizing someone. I believe Mario, Dad's new mozzarella stick friend, has some low-level mafia ties. With The Sopranos off the air, there's also plenty of the cast members who are no longer employed, and I'm sure one or more would be open to making a cool $350. A different approach, but effective nonetheless. Girls, cool it with the all-capital emails. Roy invented capitalizing all words and proper misspelling. I responded to this at 1:05 p.m. Another option would be for each of us to kill ourselves. Who's with me? Simone responded at 1:25 p.m. If you killed yourself, Ted would kill himself, and we shouldn't be involving any other families. Let's please try and keep the hooker tail between each other and not tell spouses and or boyfriends. This isn't something I want people knowing about. As an attorney, I'm advising all of you to stop sending emails regarding a hit and or euthanasia at this time. If you have questions regarding this matter, please just call me, not on my work phone. The next week, my father got a bid on his house to the tune of $600,000 and then threatened to sue the Asian family who made the bid for making such a low offer. Shortly after, my brother showed him his latest legal bill, which was in the amount of $23,000 and was from a law firm that he tried to sue for malpractice after they lost my father's case to make our neighbors cut down their trees in their own yard. His issue? They were pine trees, and being a Jew, my father does not appreciate Christmas trees being shoved in his face. He believed they were anti-Semitic trees and that the people living behind those trees were clearly Nazi sympathizers. Shortly after that, Glenn showed him Exhibit B, a judgment from the Martha's Vineyard Court against my father in the amount of $17,000 for a case he lost when he tried to represent himself pro se against our other neighbors, who no longer wanted to share their path to the beach with my father because my father refused to put any clothes on when he walked to the beach. After a little negotiating with the nice Asian family, they were finally able to come up to $625,000. This proved to be perfect timing for the last thing Glenn was holding in his arsenal. It was Platypus's bank statement, which said -$42.67. This was the day my father sold his home, and after all the bills and payments he needed to pay to clear his name that we know about, he was left with a little over $400,000. He agreed for Glenn to be a co-signer on his account, which gave Glenn access to monitor our father's account, as well as the right to deny Platypus money if the amount of any charge exceeds $1,000. Like a child. A very bad child who urinates on other people's furniture. By February, my brother had sent us a litany of charges on my father's latest monthly debit card breakdown, which showed a total of $201,000. Most were large but not inordinate amounts at the local McDonald's, which he seemed to frequent 3 times a day. Others were payments to nightclubs in Newark, and one big charge was a Delta Airlines flight for $754, which was dubious since my father doesn't fly. There were 4 separate charges for Sean John tracksuits, a few basketball jerseys, plus a Bluetooth. I called Glenn and asked him how it was possible to blow $200,000 in 5 months. Well, Chelsea, he's either buying 100 Angus burgers a day or flying to different parts of the country to visit other McDonald's. What? That's right. There's 2 of them. He and his 20-year-old cleaning hooker are seeing the grand old U.S. of A. They're on the way to the Grand Canyon right now. Please tell me you're kidding. No, Chelsea, I'm not kidding. He's in great spirits and mailed me a poem he sent Mom 30 years ago that he wants you to put in your new book. He said he has a feeling he isn't going to be shown in the best light because Chelsea has a tendency to confuse the details, and he doesn't want to disappoint his fans. He wants to offer you the poem for a cool $25,000. What did you tell him? I told him that I'm thinking of a phrase that begins with an F and ends with an F, and then I asked him if he'd like to buy a vowel. And he did not want to purchase a vowel. Here's the poem my father wanted $25,000 for from me to print in my book. It's called Sonnet to Sylvia, 3. I would send roses, stars to my beloved, bouquets sweet, and Barno lilies from her feet. Oh, I would send thrushes and martins skyward. Hers alone would I be, how sure of love we, who see only one another. Such blindness like a windswept sea, becalmed becomes a kindness soon. The ships sail homeward seeking port, love, unskilled but true, moves onward, lost in the wake of arms and kisses, then awakening at last, sees itself. Storms and seas and kisses run aground, only love that's lost is ever found. Chapter 10. Chunk. Flying Southwest Airlines is analogous to being the last one picked for kickball in the third grade. Initially, an A boarding pass feels like you've bypassed some system flaw and managed to come out one step ahead of the game. Getting your preference of any row and then on top of that having your choice of window, aisle, or middle seat feels borderline aristocratic. When that A boarding pass comes flying out of the ticket kiosk into your palm, the whole airport experience shifts from Dora the Explorer to Princess Grace of Monaco. That sensation quickly turns around once several B passengers walk by you and look at you like they'd rather catch herpes from back-to-back elephant sex than share a row with you. The excitement of picking the middle seat in the hopes that none of the passengers will bother to sit right next to you diminishes into fear and shame that no one even wants to sit next to you. Traveler after traveler rejects you, causing any spike in self-esteem from nabbing an A ticket to plummet into LaToya Jackson territory. Fuck off, I wanted to tell the leathery, turban-headed anorexic who saw a more appealing seatmate farther down the plane. Fuck you and that camel you rode in on. I generally don't start farting until the plane's in the air, so the rejection definitely was not ass-related. I was being tossed aside like a piece of styrofoam before anyone had even bothered to inquire about my hobbies and/or predilection for prescription pills. I vowed never to fly Southwest again, but Sarah was having her bachelorette weekend in San Francisco, and her maid of honor booked us all on the only airline that had managed to find pilots and a crew who also happened to be hilarious stand-up comedians. Normally, I would book my own flight for such affairs, but I didn't want to rock the boat for two reasons. A, this was Sarah's second engagement, so I wanted things to go off without a hitch. And B, I was physically frightened of her maid of honor, Tanya. Tanya is a friend from Sarah's childhood, and even though I've met her several times over the years, she still seems somewhat shy until she polishes off 3 to 7 Guinness stouts and then forces you to arm wrestle her. Although I take pride in working out on a semi-regular basis, I do not consider myself capable of winning any sort of wrestling match with a boy, a girl, or any sort of Pacific Islander descendant. I get incredibly anxious when challenged to any test of strength and usually end up pulling a groin muscle no matter where the area of strength being challenged is centralized. I had steered clear of Tanya for the better part of the weekend, but on the last night in San Francisco, we all came back to the main suite to continue drinking, and Tanya slowly but surely transformed herself into Michael Vick. Two of the girls had passed out on the floor, and I knew that being trapped in a hotel room with a dwindling crowd was going to minimize my ability to outmaneuver her. I was doing everything in my wheelhouse to avoid a one-on-one altercation. I averted eye contact when she tackled an innocent lamp that had said and done nothing to her. When I saw an 8-hour-old chicken finger fly through the living room into the bedroom and heard it split in two, I looked yonder. When gummy bears were being hauled in the direction of my head, with one in particular landing inside my ear, I intercepted further missiles with my hand, deftly masking my movement by cupping my ear and pretending to hear knocking at the door. I did not want to give in to the bully and let her know that I found her teasing considerably disappointing. I did, however, step in when she called room service requesting an omelet with 3 black men inside. I grabbed the phone out of her hand and told the person on the other end of the phone, "Black beans! An omelet with black beans, please!" I hung up the phone, unplugged it from the wall, and hid it in my suitcase. "God, Chelsea," Sarah said, trying to light a cigarette with the remote control. "You've really turned into a killjoy. That's something you would totally have done 5 years ago." "Did you really just hide the phone?" Tanya asked me as I stood with my hands on my hips. I knew by their reactions that certain measures were going to be dealt as a warning to me and my body. One by one, the remaining 6 of us were forced to arm wrestle again and again. It wasn't Tanya's strength that I found intimidating. It was the starry, retarded way her eyes focused on me, like Mike Tyson getting ready to feed. I didn't even try to put up a fight the first few times, but the celebratory high-fiving and hooting, combined with half a gummy bear's torso still stuck to my eardrum, were a reason to grow delirious. "Fine, you fucker, let's go," I yelled, getting into position on the floor while my friend Shannon video recorded what would inevitably turn into a violent episode of the L Word. I hoped I could turn my anger and humiliation into sort of rabies strength, but was reminded time and time again who was in charge. Losing in conjunction with the stadium cheering wasn't the worst part. After she beat each one of us, she would leapfrog onto the back of our heads, crushing our faces into the carpeting, and then spank us. It was beyond embarrassing. The next morning was pretty painful for everyone, and our ride to the airport was very quiet. Once we boarded the plane, however, a surge of energy overtook the girls, and the conversation quickly turned to Sarah's honeymoon on safari and whether she was planning on letting her fiancé fertilize her first egg in the African bush. All the rest of us went through our timelines for children, and inevitably, even though I had put on my eye shades and was trying to avoid participating in any conversation, I was the last one left to harass. "I don't want kids," I said without taking off my eye shades. "That's why I take the morning after pill every morning, whether I've had sex the night before or not. I also take calcium to keep my bones strong, and Ted and I take Ensure just to stay active. I didn't have the energy or interest in a real conversation and was secretly hoping that Tanya wouldn't order a Bloody Mary when the Sky waitress approached. Has anyone here tried Boniva? I asked the group. You should so have a baby, Tanya advised me. Of course she should, Sarah agreed. She acts like she hates kids, but it's not true. Just look at how she was last night, like a camp counselor, hiding the phone from us. You're going to change your mind, Chels. You'll probably end up with more kids than any of us. Just wait. I would rather sit next to a transgender person and discuss why every single one I've met smells like a bar in the daytime than listen to people tell me that I want to have children and I just don't know it yet. I do know, because I'm me and my feelings are the ones in my head. I don't want to have kids, and it's not a device to get attention or have conversations about. I simply find children incredibly immature and, more often than not, dumb. Oh my God, Tanya wailed. Look at this poor dog! She handed me her BlackBerry so I could look at the picture of the canine. He's redlined, so that means they're going to kill him on Monday in San Diego unless you rescue him. I pushed up my eye shades to see who she was talking to and realized it was me. He's so sweet. He's beautiful. Look at him, Chelsea. Look. Then you get him, I told her. I just rescued Lucifer 3 months ago and he's really skittish still. I have four and my husband says we're at our limit. Well, what about Sarah? I asked. I live in an apartment, Sarah replied, opening a magazine to signal that this wasn't a conversation she was interested in pursuing. Then, for good measure, she snickered and added, Chelsea, you've been trying to rescue a dog for months. I didn't have the energy to turn around and punch Sarah in the caslapus. I wanted Tanya to stop talking. I wanted to stop hearing about kids and dogs and even Beyonce if she were to come up. I was weak from the wrestling and from the detox cleanse that Ivory, Sarah, Tanya, and I decided to start that morning. The three of us had committed to do it together in anticipation of Sarah's wedding and were excited at the prospect of losing 10 to 47 pounds in 6 days. I had already ordered a thermal tracksuit to assist in shedding any additional bloat. Like every other time I've tried to deprive myself of food, my head was slowly spinning and a wave of nausea was throwing my equilibrium off course. I looked at the picture, looked at the tarmac that hadn't started moving yet, and felt feverish. I wondered how long it would take me to get my hands on some Excedrin once the plane landed, and then I wondered how cavemen dealt with hangovers without access to Excedrin. I looked at Tanya, who was staring me down from the seat next to me, and thought she would have made a good caveman. If getting a dog was what it was going to take to end the conversation so I could sleep, then that's what it was going to take. Fine, Tanya, I'll get the dog. I'll have Eva pick him up tomorrow. Who's Eva? Tanya demanded. My assistant. You can't have your assistant pick him up, Chelsea. You need to bond with him, she advised me, gripping my wrist very aggressively. I pulled my hand away with a buoyed confidence. We were in public, and she was less likely to harm me with so many witnesses. I was fed up with Tanya and wanted her off my jock. I hate to break it to you, but I have a job that requires me to actually be there during the day. I once saw a special on rescuing dogs, and the interview process is more complicated than the one for buying a cleft-palated Vietnamese adolescent. I don't really have time to head to the L.A. Pound for a cool 4.5 hours during my lunch break. I said I'd get the dog, okay? Can we just press on to something else, like when you're going to confront the fact that you're most likely a lesbian who wants to work as a night guard at a women's detention center? Sarah shot me a look, and I changed my tune quickly. The last occasion when I'd spent time with Sarah's friends from childhood was when her previous wedding was called off, and we all gathered at Tanya's mom's house in Brentwood for moral support. For reasons still unknown to me, I took the breakup harder than anyone else, including Sarah. After 3 days of me sleeping over at Sarah's apartment with the two of us in her bed and me waking up each morning in tears, Sarah basically told me she needed a break. I think we need some time apart, she informed me while I was folding her laundry one afternoon and watching Another World. I've been dumped, I have a wedding to cancel, and I need you to accept it and to move on. You need to get your life going in the right direction. It's not healthy for me to be sitting around here every day watching daytime television while you're in a house dress. I was bringing her down. I had felt so blindsided by the breakup that I didn't know if I would ever be able to date again. After that, it took a while for any of her friends to accept the fact that I wasn't deranged, and I didn't want to cause any more rumblings now. I wanted them to know that I was normal and healthy and could take on responsibilities without shitting my pants. I'll get the dog myself, I told Tanya. I promise. I did intend to get the dog, but I had zero intention of actually picking it up from the pound. Largely because the words Los Angeles came before the word pound, and the words Los Angeles at the beginning of any establishment's name imply to me large, smelly, disorganized rooms filled with large, smelly, disorganized people. My last experience with a circus tent of that caliber was with the L.A. County Women's Prison. L.A. Free Clinic, L.A. Animal Shelter, LAPD, you name it, they all sound appalling. Los Angeles came to have the same negative connotation as the word adult before something. adult braces, adult diapers, adult acne, all incredibly discouraging. The day after we returned from the bachelorette weekend, I woke up hallucinating in a pool of my own detoxification sweat. 24 hours of not eating any real food and chugging 3 38-ounce concoctions of something brown had taken their toll on my pituitary gland. By 8 a.m., I had vomited 3 times and made the executive decision that my body had too many toxins to release. Ted looked at me with my head inside the toilet and gently reminded me that starting a cleanse after a weekend of drinking wasn't the smartest life choice for me or my vessel. "I was trying to do it in solidarity with Sarah for the wedding," I whimpered, with one hand on the side of the cold toilet and the other hand making a chignon out of the hair I was trying to keep from falling in. "Cleanses are stupid, honey," he said, shaking his head. "Can I get you some ginger ale or water or oatmeal?" "Yeah, Ted. Oatmeal sounds fabulous right now. Do we have enough for 3 bowls? Instead, I stopped by Del Taco on my way into work. I ordered a breakfast burrito, and when the drive-thru attendant asked if I wanted hash browns or french fries, I yelled, "Both, bitch!" Then I took a picture of the drive-thru window on my camera phone and emailed it to Ivory and Sarah with a heading attached that read, "Breakfast Cleanse." I didn't email Tanya for obvious reasons. Eva, my assistant, confirmed that she received my email about the dog but wanted to verify that I was serious about getting it before she headed to the pound. "Well, what if he's a bad dog or something's really wrong with him when I get there?" she asked me. "Do you want me to just make a judgment call or should I bring him back no matter what?" "Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Whatever you think." "Okay, got it," she told me. "Let me just finish alphabetizing your makeup and I'll try and get back to the office before lunch. And what about Ted? Does he know about this?" "Yes," I lied. Eva and Ted were in cahoots, and if you wanted to keep something from one of them, it was best to lie to both of them. I was sitting in my partner Tom's office getting ready to tape the show when Eva walked in with the dog. "Here he is," she said, panting. "They said at the pound that they think he's half Chow, half German Shepherd, and he's a really good dog. He knows how to sit and give a paw, and his paperwork says his name is Guinness, but his tag says Princess Leia." "Is he a crossdresser?" I asked her. She frowned. "I don't know, but he really is good. I kind of can't believe it." Normally, Eva can't be trusted for a real opinion because she refuses to say anything negative or ever deliver any bad news to me. Not my favorite quality in a person, but from what I could deduce, she seemed to be right about the dog. He was wagging his tail and gently sniffing my caslapis. I stood up in order for the dog to get a hold of himself and assess the situation. He looked like the dog I grew up with, Whitefoot. "Are you Whitefoot?" I asked the dog and waited patiently for a response. "Whitefoot, is that you?" He wasn't responding to that name, and after I got out my pocket calculator and tapped some buttons, I gave up hope when I realized that Whitefoot would be 247 years old had he faked his own death. Chunk is the nickname I give to anyone I love who I also want to squeeze. I called my mom Chunk, and she called me Chunky when we would snuggle in bed together and I would squeeze her one boob. She had a mastectomy when I was 9 and never bothered to get reconstructive surgery, so on one side she had a rice pack that she put in her bra every morning, and on the other side was a giant boobie. I call Chewy Chunk, and I call Ted Chunk, and of course Sylvan is my chocolate chunk. "His name will be Chunk," I announced, and then we kissed. After that, he followed me everywhere I went. I had to go downstairs to do the show, and when I came back up 30 minutes later, he was standing in the same exact position right outside the elevator. When I went into the bathroom, he followed me in there, and when I closed the stall door for some adult privacy, he slid his body underneath the door and sat directly in front of me while I peed. We had a connection, and most important, Chunk didn't talk or bark. When he did open his mouth to say something, I said in a very authoritative voice, "No talking," and he would shut it again. After work that day, he hopped right into my car, and he sat in the back seat with his nose on my console. I lowered the window so he could feel the moist marina wind blow through his snout. "You will eventually need goggles," I informed him. We got home that night, and I took him for a walk while I braced myself to clean up a giant doggy shadoobie. My childhood experiences involving dog feces had never begun or ended well, and I knew that this was what had held me back from getting a dog earlier in my adult life. Vomit and feces are 2 reasons I've decided not to procreate. That and the fact that I never want to see the inside of Disney World or a Chuck E. Cheese again. Even as a toddler, I found both establishments insulting. I grabbed the plastic bag available outside the dog run and knew I was at a crossroads, not unlike Beyonce in Dreamgirls. I was turning a corner, and that corner involved a dog's bowel movement. Right away, Chunk and I understood each other. He couldn't do it. He squatted to drop his deuce, then looked at me, then stood back up and ran over to me. I even let him off his leash to allow extra relaxation, but as long as he could smell me, he refused to shadoobie. The most amazing part was that he was free to escape me permanently, but would keep running back to me. I never had a dog in my life that didn't try to escape when presented with the opportunity, although in complete fairness, I would have left our family too had I had the financial capabilities. Anytime Muttley or Whitefoot, the dogs from my childhood, got loose, we'd have to get into the car and drive around the neighborhood, leaning on the horn, trying to trick the dog into coming back. "Come on, Whitefoot, let's go for a ride," my dad would yell through a megaphone he stole from my softball practice. "Get in the goddamn car!" When Ted arrived home that night, I said, "Chunk, this is Chunk." Then I turned to Ted and said, "Chunk, meet Chunk." "What is that?" Ted asked. "It's a cat." "Whose is it?" "He's ours now." "That's very funny. Whose dog is it?" "He's our dog. I captured him." "They were going to assassinate him, Ted. He was going to be put in the electric chair. He's a rescue, like Chewy." "Chelsea, can you cut the shit, please? We've already had one dog escapade this year. I'm not really in the mood to deal with Dudley Pardieu. You don't even like dogs." "There is no shit to cut. This was a moment of weakness born out of a moment of detoxification. I like this dog. He seems to understand me and the pickle I found myself in." "Oh, what pickle is that?" I eyed Ted very closely and cocked my head to the side. "Wanting to snuggle with someone who doesn't speak." "Did it ever occur to you, maybe, to ask me if I wanted to weigh in on the decision, since I happen to live here, too?" "Not really." "Chelsea, a dog is a big decision, and we both travel all the time. Who do you think is going to take care of it?" "Roy is moving here in 3 days. He loves dogs. It will be his welcoming gift, just like my father's frozen calamari for the renters on the vineyard. My brother loves dogs." Ted darted his eyes back and forth between the dog and me, not knowing what to believe. "I'm not stupid. You obviously borrowed the dog from someone, and this is a joke." "Who would I borrow a dog from? You don't borrow dogs from people. You either steal them or you find them. Since when are there loaner dogs available?" "Chelsea, please stop. I've had a long day and I'm really just not in the mood. This is just like that mini horse you said you were buying for your sister." The mini horse he was referencing was not a joke at all, and if it was, the joke ended up being on me. Chewy and I had to take our annual Christmas photo, and one of my producers suggested bringing a mini horse he knew about that maybe Chewy could ride. The horse was about 3 feet tall, and upon sight, I made an offer to his trainer, Bruce, to purchase him. Bruce was a giant dick and feigned surprise bordering on disgust when I asked him how much he wanted for the horse. "This little fellow's not for sale," he informed me. "They take a lot of work, a lot of attention," he said with a snicker, and then he added, "and they don't like vodka." I wanted to kick Bruce in the taint. No one is just one thing. Many things contribute to the whole of a person, and just because vodka accounts for 50% of my body weight doesn't mean I walk around with a vodka drip, forcing every plant, person, or animal to imbibe. I've always had a disliking for animal trainers, and this guy cemented my theory that people who chaperone animals for a living have never had a girl sit on their face. I went upstairs after my little incident with the Bruce photo and Googled mini horse. There turned out to be several websites and several mini horses available for purchase, and I didn't need some animal trainer to approve the purchase. I learned that, just as with dwarves, there was some sort of chromosomal deficiency that made these horses so small. I felt an instant connection to these miniature horses because of my work with Chewy, and I needed to have full access to one as soon as possible. After more research, I discovered that it is legal to have a mini horse as a house pet as long as you have a backyard that meets certain measurements. Not only did my sister Sloane's yard meet the requirements, but she also had a little girl named Charlie along with a newborn named Russell, whose head Charlie liked to squeeze on a semi-regular basis. This would be the perfect outlet for her to take her frustrations out on, allowing Sloane more time to figure out why all her babies were born with flat heads. I called Sloane and gave her the news. "Charlie can ride it all day long, and the only thing you have to do is get a fence in your backyard." She went online to check out the horse and was ecstatic. "Oh my God, they're so adorable! Why don't you get one?" "Because, Sloane, I live in a building. I have no yard. They need to be ridden." "But what about Buddy?" Buddy was my sister's cat, who had been missing for 2 years. "Sloane, Buddy is gone, and he's not coming back. He could be halfway to Arkansas by now." "Well, he'd be way past Arkansas by now." "You don't know that. You don't know what that cat's dreams were. He could have settled in the Midwest. What do you have against Middle America, Sloane?" "First of all, Chelsea, he's on the vineyard because that's where we lost him. So unless he took the ferry boat across to the mainland, he's on the island. Mike and I are going again to look this summer." "Well, good luck with that plan. In the meantime, I see a mini horse in your future." Sloane and Mike losing their cat was as predictable in my view as Donnie and Marie Osmond making love. They took the cat from a friend who was divorcing and moving into an apartment building that didn't allow animals. I liked the cat because he was significantly overweight and orange, my favorite color for cats, but it was still a cat and basically might as well have been an iguana. Charlie terrorized the poor thing, always pulling on its tail and chasing it. The cat's new life sucked. I knew it, Sloane knew it, even my father knew it. That cat's gonna head for the hills the minute he sees an opportunity. Don't take that cat to the vineyard if you want to keep him. The very instant he sees the view from our house, he's gonna want to live at the beach. The fact that cats hate water and the beach and could therefore give two shits about an ocean view escaped my father, another example of him believing that anyone who set foot on his land would most surely want to take up full-time residence there. Well, what if Buddy comes back, though, and then the horse eats him? Sloane asked me. Horses do not eat cats. Coyotes eat cats, and snakes eat cats. Snakes eat people, too, but we're losing focus. We're not getting you a snake. I'll get you the horse, we'll get a big fence to encompass your yard, and I think they just eat grass and hay, right? You'll have to clean up his dumps, which according to my research shouldn't be that massive, but that sounds like a job for Mike anyway. We agreed I would move forward with the purchase of the mini horse and have it sent to New Jersey. It was impossible to choose one because they were all so amazing, but I finally selected a little brown nugget horse whose name was Simon. I was hoping to come across one with the same name as that dickhead animal trainer Bruce, but there was no such luck. I called everyone I knew to tell them about the website. Ted, of course, thought the whole thing was a dumb idea. They're going to get sick of that horse in a week, and Charlie will poke it in the eye. The horse will be miserable, and so will Sloane. You don't just get something because it's cute, Chelsea. You have to think things through. This is why we're never going to Africa. Sloane called me the next day and told me Mike had said no to the horse, and she was starting to think it wasn't such a smart idea either. What are you talking about, Sloane? This horse is going to improve your quality of life. Charlie will be busy every day riding him like a little cowgirl. You won't have to worry about her pulling Russell's ear off or trying to shove dinner rolls in his ass crack. I can't do it, Chelsea. I'm sorry. It just doesn't make any sense. I didn't talk to Sloane for a few days. And for weeks afterward, every time I saw a horse or a cat or a horse that looked like a cat, I was an emotional wreck. I looked at Chunk, who was staring at the leftover hamburger meat in the Ziploc bag in my hand. He's got an erection, I told Ted. Ugh, gross. Don't shame him. He has to know this is an open household where he can express himself. Can you please tell me whose dog this is, Chelsea? He said, throwing his hands up in the air. I'm telling you, he's ours. He is part of our family now. It could be worse. What if I decided I wanted a baby? Then you'd really be fucked. It took Ted a little while, but he finally realized Chunk was not a joke and went over to pet him. Well, what's his name? Chunk. Well, I thought I was Chunk, Ted asked. That's going to confuse both of us. How am I going to know which one of us you're talking to? From now on, Ted, I said, taking a seat at the kitchen table, I will always be talking to the dog. That's great, Chelsea. Has he eaten? He asked, eyeing the dog. Yes, I just made him some hamburger meat and steamed clams. He'll be fine until tomorrow. Eva's picking up some real dog food in the morning. No, Chelsea, you cannot feed a dog clams. In the shell? Why not? Dogs can't eat human food. I'll go down to Ralph's and get him something, Ted volunteered. I have a special recipe I do for dogs. Oh, really? I would like to hear that recipe. I do half dry food and half Alpo, he said, very slowly and very dramatically. I looked at him, walked into my bedroom, and shut the door. Then I opened it, let Chunk the dog in, and shut it again. I had no idea where or how to start explaining to Chunk what we were dealing with. How do you explain to a child that his father will try to feed him Alpo? I didn't even know Alpo was still in business, and I certainly didn't know Ted was on their board of directors. As if this weren't bad enough, the next morning Ted schooled me in dog training. I was in the shower, and Chunk was standing outside chivalrously looking away while I put my body through a rinse cycle. Ted walked in, said good morning to the dog, then put his hand above Chunk's head and pushed it through the air. He instructed Chunk to sit, which Chunk did on command. Chelsea, this is how you tell a dog to sit, he announced, doing the same thing 50 million other people do when they want their dogs to sit. I hadn't even finished lathering my shampoo into my hair when I kicked open the shower door. Oh, really, dog whisperer? Is that how you do it? You know what, Chelsea? How am I supposed to know if you know dog tricks? He said, throwing up his hands in hopelessness. Are you being serious right now, Ted? I really must know. Chelsea, you don't even like dogs. Telling a dog how to sit is not only not a trick, it's probably the single most universal thing in the world aside from army salutes and brownies. I wish my new dog didn't have to be subjected to this kind of humiliation, but this was his life now, and he needed to know what we were up against. We would be in this together, and I felt relieved to finally have an ally, someone who understood me, loved me, and didn't know how to disagree with me. When I told my sister Simone about the new addition to my family, she said, this sounds a little overwhelming for someone with your limited skill set, Chelsea. You've already killed 3 fish. Have you thought about putting Ted down? I told you Ted said those fish were starter fish who were sacrificing their lives to stabilize our aquarium, and then we'd get pretty fish. Why do you keep bringing that up? After word spread that I'd gotten a dog, I received some of the most annoying emails I've ever encountered. Friends wanted to know if I wanted to arrange doggy playdates, lists of dog parks in my area, advice on what food to feed him, how to socialize him. Essentially, a collection of people I decided to end friendships with. The only doggy activity I was prepared to do was doggy style, and I'd be lying if I said that hadn't lost its appeal sometime around my sweet 16. I always thought people were annoying with their baby advice, but this seemed like it might be worse. I had spent my entire life with one dog or another, and aside from being emotionally unstable, each family dog we had seemed like a pretty cut-and-dried case. They started out as puppies, grew up, and then died, in no specific order. The one person I allow to take Chunk for overnight visits is my friend Michael. He's a gay man with his own dog and is obsessed with Chunk and insists on calling him Chunkity Chunk. He has Chunk every Saturday for an overnight slumber party and then reports back to me on Sunday how he and Chunk talked for hours and that dogs are really the only people who understand him. "I have a special language that dogs understand," he'll tell me in his deep Texan twang. He'll lie on top of me and I'll give him a 4 to 5 minute deep tissue massage and he loves it. Then I'll turn on your TV show and watch it, and Chunk will sit right down in front of the TV and stare right at you. He loves the show. He is such a special dog, Chelsea. I just have such a love for him. He's so funny. It's pointless trying to tell Michael that dogs aren't funny simply because they are dogs and they are incapable of telling jokes or getting them, for that matter. It's pointless to tell Michael much of anything because he's in a world all his own and he has the attention span of an espresso maker. He also has a pretty unhealthy, though seemingly innocuous, relationship with his own dog. I wanted to make sure there was nothing going on with Chunk that I would be alarmed by. "You're not putting your finger in my dog's asshole, right?" I asked him one afternoon on the phone. I didn't really believe that he was, but I had just finished Mia Farrow's autobiography, and I didn't want to be one of those mothers who let their child hang out with a Woody Allen type who was doing inappropriate things to their flesh and blood. "Chelsea Handler, I would never, ever, ever put my finger in any dog's asshole. I wouldn't hurt any animal on this earth for all the money in the world. I love dogs, and I love Chunk, and I think you know that I would never hurt a fly." That's not the point, Michael. You can never fit your finger into a fly's asshole. "Chelsea, please don't do this." "Okay, I'm sorry. As a mother, I just had to ask." "I understand. I do think Chunk is gay, though. And I also want to be put in your will just in case you die so that I get Chunk. Ted won't care, right?" Michael still takes Chunk every weekend, and I know he doesn't stick anything in his asshole because Chunk gets so excited every time Michael shows up to take him. And I know Chunk is straight because he tested negative for the gay virus. Chunk still follows me around all the time, but he has chilled out a little bit, mostly because he saw the toll it was taking on me when Ted did the same thing. Once in a while, Ted and I would forget to put the food away and then come home to find the remains of a wheel of brie spread across our duvet and Chunk passed out next to the bed. It happened only every so often, but when it did, our entire condo smelled like a foot, and I'm convinced that my mother has reincarnated herself as Chunk. Spreading brie over my bedspread and coming back to life as a dog is totally something my mother would do. To this day, Chunk has still not taken a dump in front of me, and I respect him for it. I always said I would never get a dog until they came out with one that didn't have an asshole. The fact that Chunk had no problem taking a dump in front of Ted made me respect him more. I hoped that one day soon, the two of them would be able to take dumps together. Chapter 11, Deep Thoughts by Chelsea Handy. My tendency to make up stories and lie compulsively for the sake of my own amusement takes up a good portion of my day and provides me with a peace of mind not easily attainable in this economic climate. The following is a catalog of lies that have been left open-ended, and in all of these instances, the victims have not been made aware that they have fallen prey to complete and utter nonsense. Dumbassness is the word I would use to describe the condition they suffer from. Silly Sully. My friend Stephanie believes that Sully, the pilot who landed the U.S. Airways flight on the Hudson River, is currently my personal pilot. Ted and I arrived in Turks and Caicos a day after Stephanie on a regular plane like everyone else. That night at dinner, Ted mentioned the turbulence on the flight and casually mentioned that had Sully been our pilot, he would have been a lot less stressed. Stephanie was sitting a couple of seats down and asked me if she had heard correctly. "Did I hear you say Sully, the guy who landed that plane? Was he your pilot?" "He's an American hero is what he is." "I know he is," she exclaimed, "but how did that happen?" "Well, Ted called and offered him a bunch of money right after he landed that plane. Apparently, he's a huge fan of the E! Network and Keeping Up with the Kardashians. He now provides this service for a lot of people. We're third on his list, so if no one else is flying that day, we get him. He's actually a pretty interesting guy." "That is so cool," Stephanie exclaimed, while everyone else at the table was rolling their eyes, except for my brother Roy, who's always been a little slow on the uptake. Ted got up from his seat and moved down to the other side of the table that night in Turks and Caicos, while I explained to Stephanie that Ted wasn't the best flyer and Sully had basically become a member of our family. He and Ted go golfing together all the time. He was supposed to actually come on this trip, but Beyonce needed him tomorrow. He says she uses the Thighmaster on every flight for the entire flight. That's why she looks so good. She just sits there working out her thighs for hours straight while Jay-Z raps. Oh my God, Steph cried. She is such a mess. My friend Paul was sitting across from me, shaking his head and pretending to be texting on his BlackBerry. Eva piped up. Sometimes he lets Ted sit in the cockpit. That is so cool. Ted must feel like one of the Beatles. Who else is on the list before you? Steph asked me. Well, it's so funny that you just said the Beatles because it's actually Beyonce first and then Sir Paul McCartney. Stephanie stopped chewing her food. Shut up. I never told Stephanie I was kidding, and sometime later when I was flying out for a stand-up show in Atlantic City, she texted me on the way to the airport and asked if I was flying with Sully. Yep, he just texted me that he got Marley and me for the flight. How cute is that? I want to meet him. Also, see if you can get any more dish on Beyonce and Jay-Z, she wrote. I already did. Apparently, Beyonce has to load up an entire separate plane for her wardrobe because Sully hates the House of Darion and thinks Beyonce's mother is trying to exploit her own daughter with her tacky designs. Sully refuses to do it. He's way in on the drama. Who knew a pilot from Pennsylvania would have such a good eye? She responded. Please keep me in the loop. Invite him to your birthday this year. He sounds like one of us. I'm on it, I typed back. As for my brother, I'm unclear if he even knew who we were talking about since there's a chance he entirely missed the news story about Sully landing on the Hudson in the first place. The Challenger. A year ago, I told one of the writers on my staff, Heather McDonald, that I was being offered the main role in a movie about Krista McAuliffe and the Challenger space shuttle blowing up. Heather is by far the most gullible person on my staff, and all the writers on the show are constantly making up ridiculous stories to tell her just for the sake of our own amusement. She's not stupid. She just seems to love anything involving free items, money, or drama. The weird part, I told her, is that it's a comedy, and they're allowing me to hire my own writer to write my part. This was enough to pique Heather's interest and motivate her to put some ideas together and get a head start before some of the other writers came up with anything substantial. Meryl Streep is playing Krista McAuliffe, I added, but she's dead and only comes down from heaven to talk to me in the movie. My partner Tom walked into my office halfway through this debacle and took no time to jump in and add his own spin. Chelsea plays her daughter, who grew up never knowing her mother and is now married and in the process of becoming an astronaut. But every time she gets into a space shuttle, she has terrible flashbacks about the day. Are you going to do it? Heather asked me. Yes, obviously I'm going to do it. Meryl Streep? I can't pass that up. And they have an offer out to Hank Azaria to play my husband. That's so weird, she sat on my sofa in my office looking at me. How can they make this a comedy? That's where you come in, Heather, Tom told her. We're going to have all the writers submit ideas for the storyline, since the studio is willing to hire a personal writer from Chelsea's staff to outline the story. They definitely wanted to have a comedic twist. It's just so weird that they want to make it a comedy, she said. That was a really horrible event. It is weird, I agreed. It's downright creepy. But who am I to take a moral stand on someone else's vision? That's why I need help. I'm going to ask all the writers to come up with an outline for the movie and some really funny scenes. Apparently, there's going to be a lot of improv. Meryl loves improv, I guess, and never really gets to do it. She does? Yes, Tom assured her. I've seen her talk about it on Inside the Actor's Studio. She feels robbed. Well, it is a good subject for a movie. I mean, everyone remembers where they were that day. I remember when they announced that the Challenger blew up. I was in fifth or sixth grade, I think, she said. Yeah, I remember too, although I was younger, of course. So basically, Tom interjected, you need to write a few pages of dialogue and or plot lines and submit them along with the other writers, and then we're going to decide who will make the $75,000 writing fee. $75,000? Heather asked. At least, he told her. It could even turn out to be more. How soon can you get something to us? I'll start working on it this weekend, she said. Is there any other information you can give me? Well, I added, my husband in the movie hates for me to be in space. He just wants me to do something where I spend the majority of time on Earth. There's actually a scene where I shit my pants in a space shuttle simulator. I looked at Tom, who had turned around and was going through my belts. I already told her they have an offer out to Hank Azaria to play my husband, Tom. No, Tom corrected me. Actually, the last I heard was that he passed and they were going in a different direction. They were going to make an offer to Justin Timberlake, who they say is interested. Oh my God, shut up! Heather wailed. No way! I exclaimed, jumping out of my seat. I have to do it now. You have to do it. Let me start brainstorming. She got up to go to her office. One last thing. Do they have a title? She asked me. Yes, Tom interjected. It's called The Sky Is Crying. Turks and Caicos. At some point during our vacation, Sylvan asked me if my friend Paul was gay, which he is. Instead of giving him a straightforward answer, I saw an opportunity and told Sylvan that not only was Paul gay, but that he was actually still a woman who was currently going through gender reassignment surgery. He was raised as a boy until he was 18 and started dating a girl. He found out that boy parts are different from girl parts and that he had the exact same parts as his girlfriend. Gender reassignment is a pretty laborious process, so each month he got estrogen injections and his body had been slowly transforming his girl parts into male parts. After this trip, he was getting his penis.
Holy shit, Jos!
Sylvan was horrified.
What happened to the girl?
She was freaked out, I told him. She enlisted in the military immediately after he told her and has since been deployed to Iraq.
So he's got girl parts right now?
Yes, he has a clitoris, but after this vacation is when they inject him with the hormones to enlarge the clitoris into a full-blown penis.
Why didn't he want to stay being a girl?
Because he spent his whole life thinking he was a boy and associates more with boys. If you look closely at his tits, you can see that they used to be bigger.
Oh my God, bloody hell, Chos.
Sylvan was rubbing his head.
I've never heard anything like this.
Yep. What they do is they give you pills to basically turn your clitoris into a penis. Pretty fucked up, huh? Sylvan and I were on a boat watching Paul swim around with a snorkel looking for fish.
He looks so much like a guy, Sylvan said.
I know. It's taken a lot of work for him to get there. He used to have longer hair than mine. It's amazing to actually watch the transformation. His body's been through so many stages. At least now people think he's a guy. There was a time not long ago when you couldn't tell what he was. Sylvan was flabbergasted and I was having the time of my life. He was still rubbing his head as if he were in pain and asked me,
So is he technically a boy or a girl right now?
Right now, he's both. His parents, wanting a boy, decided that even though he had a caslapis, they would raise him as a boy. After he found out he was a girl, he got into real estate because he knew that was the quickest way to make a buck, and he's been saving money ever since to make the change.
But Chos, he looks and talks and walks like a guy,
Sylvan told me. I know, Sylvan. Medicine is amazing, I declared. Amazing. His real name is Bernice, but his parents just called him Bernie, and then when he found out that they were lying to him his whole life, he changed his name to Paul. Sylvan couldn't stop asking questions, and luckily I had an answer for each one. When Paul came in after snorkeling, Sylvan got up and handed him a towel. He also started pulling out Paul's seat each night at dinner, which clearly confused Paul every time, but was enjoyable for me to watch.
I don't get it, Chos, Sylvan asked. Does he like girls or boys? Boys! But if he likes boys, wouldn't it have been easier just to stay a girl instead of becoming a man and then becoming gay?
That's a pretty good fucking question, Sylvan, I told him. One that I ask myself every day when I look at Paul's ass. It's hard to understand the transgender community and what their thoughts are, why they want to cross two hurdles instead of one. But I don't ask questions, Sylvan. I don't judge. I'm not the Lord. At the end of the trip, Sylvan told Paul that he was one of the most amazing people he'd ever met, and that Paul had more guts and courage than half those soldiers who go over to Iraq.
Thank you, Sylvan, Paul said quizzically.
That's a really nice thing to say to someone, I think.
Gosh, Eva remarked to Paul, you must really have made an impression on him.
Paul told me after that he felt bad for judging Sylvan based on the fact that he couldn't swim. That guy's a real sweetheart through and through. You should have heard what he said to me when we said goodbye. I'm definitely going to use him as a driver the next time I'm in New York.
You should definitely use him, I told Paul.
Ike Turner. On the same trip, Paul and I got into a food fight one night around 3 a.m. This is something we frequently participate in after 7 to 10 cocktails. We're respectful enough to do it only in the privacy of our hotel room, and I usually end up the champion, as Paul is gay, which can lead to terrible hand-eye coordination. While we don't intentionally involve others, it usually requires anyone else in the room to run and duck for cover, as it can get pretty violent, with one or two food items ending up stuck to a wall and Paul screaming that I'm an angry dyke. I'm more apt to fight with Paul instead of someone like Tanya, because I consider Paul to be more of an equal and Tanya to be more of a mad harlot. Things got particularly hairy one night on our vacation in Turks and Caicos, and fruit throwing eventually graduated from grapes and decorative acorns to ripe nectarines. When I turned around to peg a strawberry in Paul's direction, I didn't have time to duck before a nectarine hit me square in the eye. It hurt, but not enough to make me cry, and I quickly recovered, although all of our other friends were a little taken aback at our level of violence. Ted scolded us both. Stop it, you two! Chelsea has a television show, and I already gave her one black eye when we were playing Wii tennis. People are going to think I beat her. Sylvan was more impressed with Paul's hand-eye coordination because at this point, he didn't know if Paul was a boy, a girl, or a sea animal. Either way, the party came to a screeching halt with Paul really concerned that he'd hurt me. He hadn't, but when I woke up the next morning, my friend Stephanie suggested that it would be a good idea to have me fake a black eye. With Eva and Stephanie's help, I was able to make one side of my face look like Rihanna's, and then I headed down in the bright sunlight with a hat and sunglasses like any respectable abused woman. My brother, Roy, Delicious, Ted, Paul, and Sylvan were all down at breakfast already when the girls and I arrived. When Paul saw my face, he was horrified. I assured him it was no big deal and that I had time to heal before I had to tape the show again. "Don't worry," I told him, "I bruise easily. If it's still there by Monday, I'm sure my makeup artist can cover it up. Or I'll just tell the audience my friend hit me with a nectarine." "You should take some iron," Ted told me as he got up from the table, giving me a thumbs up for my cosmetic handiwork. Ted was in our room that morning when I applied my shiner and was excited to finally be included in a joke. "Good job, Paul," Ted told him and threw his napkin down on the table dramatically before heading over to his beach chair. Not knowing it was a joke, Sylvan was disgusted by the whole event. He said to Paul, "If you weren't a girl, I would have the right mind to hit you." And then he stormed off. Brian, Roy, and Paul all looked at each other, wondering what Sylvan was talking about, until I explained to them that Sylvan didn't have a ton of experience with gay men and that calling men girls was just English slang for gay guys. Shortly after, I explained to Sylvan that the whole thing was a joke, that Paul really hadn't hurt me, and just to go along with it. He was bellowing with laughter,
"Jose, you're a maniac! I can't believe I fell for that! And what an idiot he is, too, for believing it!"
"I know," I said to Sylvan. "Can you believe how stupid everyone is?" As the day wore on, Eva, Steph, and I kept making the bruise darker and darker until finally Paul took me aside with tears in his eyes. Paul has an exorbitant amount of energy and an annoyingly sunny disposition. He has the tendency to look at every situation as a glass half gay and is the type of person who says, "Bless his heart," when he sees someone in a wheelchair getting off a ski lift.
"Chelsea," he whimpered, "I just feel terrible. You're so generous to all of us, and you've been such a good friend, and I thank you by hitting you in the face with a nectarine. And look at you. You look awful."
"Don't worry about it, Paul. I'm seriously not mad at you. I know it was a total accident." When tears started to fill his big gay eyes, I took a towel and wetted it with a bottle of water. "Look," I told him, "it will probably just wipe off." With Stephanie's video camera capturing the event, including the disappearance of the bruise, Paul realized what I had done.
"You are horrible," he screamed. "Horrible, horrible. You're a horrible, angry dyke."
One-legged wonder. A while back, I tried to set my friend Sarah up with my brother Roy to no avail. "Whatever happened to hooking him up with Sarah?" my Mormon sister asked me when my sisters and I were on a three-way phone call discussing the fact that our brother had been single for far too long. "It's a little late for that since she's getting married in 2 weeks. Listen, I do love Roy, and I'd be willing to break up most relationships if it meant giving him one, but I've grown to love Sarah's fiancé, even though Farouj is Iranian and only has one leg."
Come again?" Simone asked me.
"I told you guys this already," I lied.
"No, Chelsea, I think I would have remembered if you told me that Sarah's fiancé was legless. Is he in a wheelchair?"
"No, I really can't believe I didn't tell you this already. He lost one of his legs in Iraq."
"Well, I thought he was an editor," Sloane asked.
"He is," I confirmed, "but he volunteered for the war and he lost his leg in combat, so he's got one of those plastic thingamajiggies."
"Hold on a second," Simone said. "Sarah is marrying someone with no leg?"
"He has one leg. You guys are being really judgmental. He loves her and she loves him. It's not like he can't walk around."
"So let me get this straight," Sloane asked. "She rejected Roy for a one-legged soldier? Is he Republican too?"
"No, don't be ridiculous. He's a Democrat."
"Where's the leg?" inquired Sloane. "I have no idea where the leg is, Sloane. This isn't CSI Miami. I didn't ask where the leg is. Obviously, it's gone. It's probably still somewhere in Afghanistan."
"Chelsea, you just said Iraq," Simone reminded me. "Is this one of your stupid stories? Because it sure sounds stupid."
"Then ask her yourself," I yelled, exhausted, like I'd make up someone losing their leg. A week later, Roy moved out to Los Angeles to be the caterer for my show. He had come to learn about Farouj's leg through my sisters and had questions of his own. Sarah was nice enough to invite Roy to her wedding since he was new to L.A., and when Roy watched Sarah and Farouj dance to their first song, he leaned over and said to Ted, "For a guy with one leg, that guy can really move. Are Iranians known for dancing?" It didn't take long for Ted to come over and inform me that not only did he confirm my lie about Farouj's having one leg, but he also took it up a notch and told Roy that Farouj was able to score Heather Mills' old leg on eBay for only $1,500. Not an amazing attempt to corroborate my story, but a valiant effort nonetheless, especially for someone who took so long to get on board with my chronic storytelling. I was just glad we were finally on the same team, like Serena and Venus playing doubles together. Not opponents, but large, black teammates. The end. These are the people I acknowledge. Michael Broussard, Beth DeGuzman, Jamie Robb, Sarah Weiss, Ann Toomey, Grand Central Publishing, Hachette Book Group, and the main person involved in getting everyone to give away all of their rights. Eva Magdalensky from Denver. My sisters and brothers for giving me a life. It's safe to say your efforts in me paid off. I acknowledge my father, although I don't appreciate his body type or complete lack of morality. Steve Marmelstein, Jen Kirkman, Heather McDonald, Johnny Malord, Chris Frangiola, Sarah Colonna, Brad Wallach, Jeff Wild, Guy Branham, and Sue Murphy for carrying me when I am too tired to carry myself, like footprints in the sand, but not really. Tom Brunell is responsible for me having any time to write a book, and responsible for allowing me to sleep in, and responsible for me having a successful mid-level cable show. I love you dearly. Also, thank you, India. And finally, thank you, Belvedere Vodka, for keeping me sane. Thanks for listening to my book. There's another one coming out soon.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Chelsea Chelsea Bang Bang. Written and read by Chelsea Handler. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Bill Kaplan and Scott Smolev. Post-production by John Colucci. Chelsea Chelsea Bang Bang is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by Chelsea Handler. Audio production copyright 2014 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.